Isn't it amazing we get to be in the presence of a God whose goodness hunts us down? That is a pretty good thing. Can we say amen to that? Amen. Can you give the worship leaders a hand, ladies and gentlemen? They always do such a good job. We are finishing our journey through the book of Ecclesiastes today, this Old Testament book of alternative wisdom that's been so fascinating. We're doing a several month long series called Passion and Wisdom, and Ecclesiastes was the wisdom part. Next week we'll start Psalms for the passion part. And today's last message is entitled, you know how I love my titles, Joy, Ups and Downs, and Bread. But I'm going to throw you a little curveball here today. Brandy Selby, a middle school teacher from Thurston, I've been bugging her to preach forever, and she finally agreed, and she's going to tag team, and she's going to talk a little about joy, and then I'll come up and finish the message off with the ups and downs and the bread. So Brandy, give her a hand. Welcome up.
Good morning. So when Tim asked me to speak a while ago, I had to wonder what made me qualified. I really don't know any Bible verses. I've been known to cuss a lot. I have tons of anxiety, which makes me doubt my decisions, my ability, my life, whether God's real, just that stuff. So yeah, super qualified. But I am a teacher, and having the chance to address a captive audience with a microphone and people who are probably not drawing penises on things in the back of the room where I can't see them was just too great for me to give up, so I jumped at the chance. So he gave me some choices about what to talk about. One of them was the necessity of joy. And I thought, you know what? I am a middle school teacher. It's a no-brainer. I'm sure you're all thinking, man, her day must be surrounded by joy. Middle school, best time of your life. So yeah. And I will say, as a middle school teacher, I tell my kids at school all the time, when I meet new people and I tell them I teach middle school, the reaction is always, oh, or oh, I'm sorry. Or they sort of imply I wasn't good enough to get a better job. And I'm not joking about that. But the reality is my experience at middle school makes me a really great person to tell you about why we need joy. And in reading Ecclesiastes, I realized that I'm not the only person who's had the same experience. But as a teacher, a good teacher, your first shot out of the gate is a vocab lesson. So as a biblical scholar, now that I'm giving a sermon, I went online and I Googled what is biblical joy, because that felt like a good place to start. And I didn't realize that there really are kind of two different kinds of joy. And the first type would be what I've now called normal person joy. You can call it that to other people now because you've heard it in a sermon. So normal person joy is more of that internal happiness, I think is a good way of putting it. It's dependent on what's happening in your life. Things are going okay. You're able to experience happiness. You get a tax return that you didn't expect. You had a great meal. You connect with family that you haven't seen in a while. It's kind of that no-brainer joy. Anybody would find it. Biblical joy is a little bit different because biblical joy is dependent on God, I think. It's the ability to appreciate those really small moments that would be easy to overlook. It's the quiet parts that happen in the middle of our big, messy lives. It's the stuff that actually sustains us that we might not even recognize is coming into our lives. Now, here's the deal. I feel like this type of joy is dependent on God. There are plenty of people out there who don't have great God experiences, who would say they don't depend on God for that. And I am not the person to explain why that is. I'm going to leave that to Tim and maybe Jean. I think Jean might be able to also answer some stuff about that. Jean knows so much, you guys. Do a supper club, you'll learn that about people. But this type of joy is, to me, joy that God puts in our lives, and it's up to us to pick it up. But remember, I don't even know Bible verses. I'm not going to try and explain that. But back to my job. Middle school is tough. But these are kids. They're 12 years old. They are doing what they can to live. At the beginning of the year, I have kids write me a letter to just give me a little information about their lives. And I have kids whose parents have died, who've been abused, whose siblings have died. They're wearing old and fitting clothes because there's no money, even though there might be money. And they don't get any of it. It's sad. They're literally paying for the sins of others with their lives. And their short experience as humans really shows we have to find some places to have joy in our lives. Because otherwise, what would our life be, right? This is where biblical joy comes in. The teacher in Ecclesiastes, the first verse that I was looking at, totally gets how terrible and wrong this is. He writes in 8:14, there's something else meaningless that occurs on earth. The righteous who get what the wicked deserve, and the wicked who get what the righteous deserve. This too, I say, is meaningless. No kidding. We see this happen all the time. It's the kind, wonderful person who just does everything for everyone else, yet has horrible things happening to them again and again. It's also the person who's cruel and never seems to care about what other people do, yet they get the promotion or they have the life that just seems so easy. We see that. And what the teacher says here is, hold on, don't read too much into that. That is meaningless. And the reason it's meaningless is it's not up to us to decide who deserves what. That's God's job. The reality, though, is we're not going to be handed joy because that's the way life is. It is what it is. And we have to get over that and find our joy somewhere else. It's not going to just jump out at us. That's not how life works. So as I was kind of preparing this, I was listening to a podcast by Dr. Jamil Zaki. He's a professor of psychology at Stanford, and he studies cynicism. And he describes a cynic as a person who distrusts the motives of people. They view the world in a more negative light. They're really hung up on justice and what is fair, just like they describe in Ecclesiastes, the righteous and getting what you deserve. According to Dr. Zaki, oftentimes these people are regarded as wise, and we will actually go to them for their opinion because we think they're discerning. But the reality is, they have such a negative viewpoint that you kind of can't trust them. They don't know how to evaluate really what's in front of them. So it's kind of like what we said in Ecclesiastes, like life is meaningless. That's sort of their worldview. But being a poor judge of character of your circumstances is one thing. Cynical people actually have measurable mental health problems. They have really poor health, their hearts in particular, and they have a shorter life expectancy. A cynical person who does not access joy in their lives dies sooner. So Dr. Zaki was able to show that medically we need joy. It's a necessity in our lives, and without it, we don't fare nearly as well. And that's exactly what biblical joy is about. Cynics aren't wrong that life can be terrible. So as a teacher, we're going to do a little check for understanding. Have we all experienced difficult stuff, yes or no? I should also give you the sideways, but I feel like that's a binary question. We've all experienced this. This is not new, right? Life can be terrible, but we have to find happiness and fulfillment in those situations we have no control over. If we only see life in terms of what isn't fair or what we think should happen, we miss out on the joy that God puts in front of us every single day. We've turned that cynic's blind eye to the truth that God wants us to have joy. 8:15 says in Ecclesiastes, "So I commend the enjoyment of life, because there is nothing better for a person under the sun than to eat, drink, and be glad. Then joy will accompany them, bold accompany them, on their toil all the days of the life God has given them under the sun." So vocab alert here again. Toil means work, not trauma. What he's saying here is live your life as best as you can because you will toil. We have to work, and we have to work hard. Toil is hard work that you can't escape. But you'll also experience joy as you go through it. He says joy will accompany us through our toil. Now, this super depressing doom and gloom sermon really needs a ray of hope, I feel. And this is back to middle school. So I was given the chance my very first year to create my own class. And I found this book called The Book of Awesome. And it's written by a man named Neil Pasricha. He wrote it when he was going through a really difficult time. He was married and to kind of the girl of his dreams, came home one day and she said, "I don't love you anymore and I want a divorce." His best friend at the time committed suicide. And his mom had to call and tell him, "I know you were just talking to him last night, but he's gone." The world was in an economic downturn. Unemployment was high. We were learning about the ice melting and polar bears floating. And he said, life was too much for me. He wrote the Book of Awesome, he started writing these little essays. And his goal was every day, find one awesome thing, one piece of joy that maybe I would have overlooked if I hadn't been looking for it. So he started a blog called 1000 Awesome Things, and that's what he did. It ended up becoming the Book of Awesome. He realized that his toil, his going through life, needed more than what he was able to just experience without actually going out and looking for it. These little essays that he writes are about awesome things like getting free refills, creating the perfect plate of nachos where the cheese and the meat and everything works out and your last chip is as good as the first. The extra fries at the bottom of the bag that you thought you got all the fries and then you hand the stuff out and there's all kinds of extra fries and no one knows and you get those fries. That is one of those moments. That's it. And that's exactly what the teacher in Ecclesiastes is talking about. This isn't normal person joy. This isn't big stuff like a $1,000 tax return that you didn't think you were going to get. This is a moment that you could have just looked right past. These are those little situations that accompany us on our way, but that you have to pay attention to. Finding money in a parking lot is absolutely no cure for catastrophe or extreme hurt. And that's not the kind of life that I'm talking about right now. I get that. I'm talking about day-to-day life. We don't get to choose what's good, what's fair, or even what's working. The whole point of biblical joy and the fact that we need that biblical joy is, I believe, through relying on God. It has to be that God allows us to have these moments and we can stop and we can appreciate the cool side of that pillow. We can enjoy the smell of the bakery air and not just overlook it. Doing so allows us to experience all parts of life, not just the bad ones. Psalm 16:1 says, "Keep me safe, my God, for in you I take refuge." It goes on to say, "You make known to me the path of life. You will fill me with joy in your presence." Knowing God and depending on him will give you refuge and put you in the presence of joy. In closing, I want to stress something there. The verse says joy will accompany us. Not joy might or joy will probably. It says joy will. And we're all on our own paths, as it says here. And here's a spoiler alert. God put us on that path. The toil, the things that come up, that's there. And it's there for a reason, and I don't know why. Again, I'm going to turn that back to Tim. But God makes us known what's on that path. And in seeing that, it can be tough, right? Lives are tough. We already thumbs up that. But Dr. Zaki, back to the doctor I was listening to, said we don't have to go through life naively wearing rose-colored glasses, but we can't wear soot-covered glasses either. When we take refuge in God, it essentially polishes those lenses up. It gives us the gift of joy by even being able to see those awesome little joys that God sprinkles along the way, like crumbs that guide us on to a much easier journey through life. So, as you go out today, take a minute, and as I tell my kids at school, take a second and find something that's awesome that no one else would even notice. Thank you.
Thank you, Brandy. That was great. You're going to do that again. So you should have bombed on purpose if you didn't want to do this. All right. Let's talk now about ups and downs. I want to read Ecclesiastes 5, just four verses. And remember, the teacher, the author of Ecclesiastes, is talking here. This too is a grievous evil. As everyone comes, so they depart. And what they do, what do they gain? Since they toil, there's that word again, for the wind. All their days they eat in darkness with great frustration, affliction, and anger. This is what I have observed to be good, that it is appropriate for a person to eat and to drink and to find satisfaction in their toilsome labor under the sun during the few days of life God is giving them, for this is their lot. All right, when you read these verses, they sound, when you're first reading them, like crazy talk at first, because the teacher, the author of this book, is flip-flopping between sad and glad, between blessing and bummer, back and forth. You feel like you're walking back and forth between a death metal concert and a Taylor Swift concert. That's what you feel like when you're reading Ecclesiastes. And in one moment, the teacher is saying, oh, basically life sucks. And in the next breath, he says, look at all the goodness in life. We should celebrate. You might be tempted to think the teacher is crazy, but he's not. These verses go back and forth between joy and despair because life goes back and forth between joy and despair, sometimes rather quickly. I want to tell you about a woman named Amy Copeland. She's a fantastic human being. She's a psychotherapist now. And at Thanksgiving one year, her family was going around the table and listing the things that they are thankful for, which many of you guys do at your holiday dinners. And it seems weird because when it got to be her turn, she said this, and I'll put it up on the screen. I'm thankful for my right knee and my elbows. Now, that's a strange thing to list of what you're thankful for at Thanksgiving, and it seems weird until you know her story. She is a very active outdoors person, still is, but she had a freak accident while zip lining, of all things, which I absolutely love to do, and she developed a bacterial infection that was actually flesh eating that led to the amputation of both her hands, her right foot, and in her entire left leg. So 1 minute she's having a blast zip lining, and just days later she's getting multiple amputations. Now that's an extreme example, but it illustrates a really important truth. Life is full of ups and downs. Now, so many people that you know, and maybe some even your closest friends and families, when they experience downs, they usually blame them on God. That's their first thing. Throw God under the bus. They think, well, God has left me. I obviously did something that angered God or disappointed God, and God left the building, wants nothing to do with me, and that's why all these bad things are happening to me. No, that's not true. God is not fickle like that. God is sticky. Sometimes life can just be randomly icky, and we have to admit that. Ick happens. I'm changing a popular phrase to be very PG here, but ick just happens sometimes. That's why the wisdom of Ecclesiastes is so important for us. It shows us the truth that life is full of ups and downs, and we are actually free to participate fully in all of the moments of our life. The good moments and the bad moments. When everything in your life is colored in pain, you are free to cuss and scream and cry and feel that pain and know that God is in that pain with you, screaming alongside of you. And when things are going good, you're free to dance and sing and shout and celebrate and know that God is in that moment with you too, celebrating along with you. So what a fantastic freedom Ecclesiastes offers us. The freedom to stop pretending our lives always have to be good. In fact, the freedom is more than that. It's actually a freedom to stop even expecting that your life is always going to be good, because that's not reality. One thing I've found that will help you to endure the down times in your life is a word that's found all throughout Ecclesiastes, and it was actually in the verses that Brandy read, and it's the word meaningless. And if you remember earlier on, I explained that that's an unfortunate, it's a really unfortunate English translation, because that word meaningless doesn't really mean that. It's the Hebrew word havel, and it means vapor. It means vapor. So when it comes to the down in your life, it's helpful to remember that the down times are a vapor. They'll dissipate. They won't last. I am scheduled to get a flu shot and a COVID booster next Friday, and I hate shots. I have hated them my whole life, especially when I was a child. I thought, what kind of fresh hell is this that somebody I don't know is going to jab a sharp implement in my arm and tell me it's good for me? I especially remember, I'm 60, so I remember going to a schools, and all of you probably over 50 remember shot day. Remember shot day? I've told you this before, but in Klamath Falls, where I went to school in elementary school, your parents didn't tell you about shot day, because you wouldn't have gone if you knew it was shot day, okay? And the teacher didn't say anything. They just go, hey, we're all going to head towards the gym right now. Great, an assembly. You're all excited. So you're walking out there, and you're so excited. I can still, it's emblazoned in my mind. I can see all the kids in front of me from the classes that went in front of me, and we're not going to the gym, you lying sack of whatever, teacher. And we're going into the principal's office, and I thought, oh no. And then I can see the kids coming out the other door. There's two doors to the principal's office, and they're all crying. I thought, we're all getting hacks. Because back in that day, if you did something bad, you got paddled, like in public school. I go, we're all getting paddled. They're paddling the whole school today. And I walked in there, and I go, then I saw the nurse. I thought, no, it's shot day. it's shot day. And so there's Attila the Hun with her shotgun, not a shotgun, but a gun that gave you shots. It wasn't even a needle. And we just walked up, they had you roll up your arms and just bam, 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 hundreds of us just inoculated all at once. And I hated that. The only way I liked shots that I can endure them was when I went to the doctor and I had a nice nurse. And the nurse looked at me and said, this will only sting for a little bit. And I thought, okay, I can endure that. Because if she would have said, this is going to sting forever, I wouldn't have got the shot. But knowing that it was just going to last a few moments, I could get it. And it's the same with the downtimes in your life. Listen closely, and you'll hear the Spirit ever so gently whisper to you in your down moments, it's okay, this too will pass. And that's great wisdom. All right, now let's talk about bread. Oh, I'm excited about this. This is out of Ecclesiastes chapter 11. I'll just put up two verses. Ship your grain across the sea, or cast your bread upon the waters is another version of that. After many days, you may receive a return. Invest in seven ventures, yes, in eight. You do not know what disaster may come upon the land. What an odd verse, right? Because casting bread upon the water, which is a famous version of that first sentence, that seems like a weird and wasteful thing to do. It's not going to come back to you. You know science. It's going to turn mushy and sink, right? But these verses are another example of the alternative wisdom we find in this great book, okay? So let's take a closer look at these verses, starting with water. I want you to have an understanding of water. The ancients who would have first heard this book and read this book had a mystical understanding of the water. They believed water was a place where the spiritual realm and the physical realm collided, a place where God frequented. And you can see why they would believe such thing, because the ancient Hebrew scriptures were full of verses that talked about this. Like in Genesis chapter 1, the book that opens the Bible, it says, before all things were created, there was God. And what was God doing? The Spirit of God was hovering over the waters, God and water going together. And then there's Psalm 29, and these are just a few examples. It says, the voice of the Lord is over the waters. God's voice can be heard near water. So in the minds of ancient people, God and water go together. Personally, I think they still do. I really do. I have all kinds of photos on my phone, only hundreds, not thousands like some people do on my phone. And sure, some of them are people. People are great, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But I also have a lot of pictures of water, and an inordinate amount of pictures of water I discovered. Let me show you a couple. These are straight out of my phone. This is up the Green Lakes Trail. If you've never hiked it, it's one of the most amazing places of water in the state of Oregon. This next one, let's see what the next one is. Oh, this is a place I snowshoe into on the Upper Mackenzie. I'm not going to tell you where it's at because it's magical, and the veil is very thin between heaven and earth right here. So that's my screenshot. And then this was, my wife and I were kayaking in Lake Superior. Who knew that big lake could be so clean? I did not know that. Did you? It's that clean. I personally have an easier time connecting with the presence and being aware of the presence of God when I'm near water. God and water, I think, still go together. Put a comma there. Now let's examine the word bread. In these verses, when it talks about bread, it's not making a reference to actual food. It appears to be talking about our acts of generosity, the giving of our time, our talents, our compassion, even our money. Jewish literature actually tells a story behind these verses that explains this, and it's the story of Solomon and an oasis. And remember, many people think Solomon actually wrote Ecclesiastes, and he might well have done that. But the story goes like this. Solomon wants to build this temple, which he did and became famous for. But there's a particular kind of material that he really wanted to use in the building of this temple, and it was only available in a neighboring small kingdom. So Solomon's the richest dude on the earth, the most powerful man on earth. So he sent some emissaries to the small kingdom and offered to buy it at a great price. And the king turned him down. Over and over he turned him down. So finally, Solomon would have never normally done this. He journeyed across the desert to this place. And he made it there. and he asked for the materials himself, and he offered a great price. He negotiated for a week, and the king goes, no, I'm not giving it to you. Don't want to. It's ours. And that was it, for whatever reason. And Solomon was dejected. He goes, okay, I'll have to use something else. And he was packing up to go home, and a messenger was sent into Solomon's room right before he left. And the messenger said, the king wants to talk to you again. Solomon goes, odd, but he did. Walked in. The king enters the room and says, you can have all of that material you need, and you can have it for free. And Solomon was shocked and asked him, why the change of heart? He goes, because recently we went to war with another kingdom, and my son was in a battle, and he got captured, and he escaped, and he started to make his way across the desert to come home, but he hadn't eaten in days, and he didn't have any water, and he thought he was going to die, and he runs upon this oasis, and he's drinking the water and thinking, well, this is good, but I need food or I'm not going to make it, and he sees this bundle of something. And it was waterproof in an ancient technique, and it's bobbing on the water. And he grabs it and opens it, and it's this blanket that had been kind of, like I said, waterproofed, and there's food inside. And he ate it, and he made it home. And the king showed him the blanket that his son brought. He brought the bundle back home, and he goes, and it had a Star of David on it. And he goes, this is your symbol, is it not? And Solomon goes, yeah, it is. And he goes, it was you that left this food on the water that saved my son's life. Take all the material you want. Solomon had cast his bread upon the water, and the generosity of doing that had returned to him. That's how the story goes. So in these verses, we're not invited to turn all of our bread into mush, okay? We're invited to be ridiculously and recklessly generous people who cast their generosity out to all the people around us. But then we're told that we'll find our bread again, or in other words, after we spread our generosity will come back to us. Jesus echoes this sentiment when he himself says, give and it'll be given to you, a good measure, pressed down and shaken together. Now, I know a lot of people use these words as an excuse to fuel their greedy lives. They think, oh, I love that. Well, I'll give a little bit because then God will give me more and I'll have more. And it's all about their greed. They treat God like some heavenly slot machine that pays out really good. And this is gross thinking. Those words have nothing to do with greed, nor do the verses we read in Ecclesiastes. They're about us being so generous we actually create this culture of generosity around us, a community where everybody gets in on the fun of giving because generosity is contagious. It's hard to see somebody else having a blast at giving and not want to give yourself. So of course your bread comes back to you. Of course your generosity returns to you because that's the kind of community you're a part of. That's the kind of community you help create. But a little warning here. If you saw a person right now when you're going home and they're throwing bread on water and there's no ducks around, you would think, weird and wasteful. What are you doing there? Likewise, when people around you seeing you live, when they watch you live out your generosity, many of them will think, well, how silly. That is weird. Why give away so much? You could keep your time, your energy, and your money. You could spend it on yourself. You could get nicer stuff. You could pamper yourself. You could go on vacations. You could add to your Beanie Baby collection or whatever you collect, okay? You're so weird to be that generous. Give anyway. Even if people think you're weird for doing it, and I know most of you, you're weird already, so you really don't got much to lose. So just give anyway. Not only is it a blast, it's the best way to be countercultural. We live, for those of you that don't know, Eugene is the most countercultural city on the West Coast besides San Francisco. It's known for that. But the way to be countercultural isn't really to wear tie-dye and listen to the Grateful Dead and have BO and wear Birkenstocks, and all those things are fine, whatever. Being a countercultural person is really about being generous in a culture that's steeped in greed. And America has made a religion out of greed. You want to be countercultural? Be generous. So let's start slinging our sourdough on the water. But let me end with this. I'm going to tie it all together. I got so excited, I geeked out on this little section of the Bible, okay? Remember again, water for the ancients represents the nearness of God. So the picture these verses paint for all of us is this. When we cast our bread on the water, when we cast our generosity on the waters, sure, we get to bless other people. Sure, we get to experience that generosity coming back to us. Sure, we get to be countercultural, and that's all great. But to top it all off, when we cast our generosity onto the waters, in a very real way, we will experience the nearness of God, because our generosity took us to the water. Our generosity ushered us, in other words, closer to God. That's the picture that's painted for us in these verses out of chapter 11. How cool is the wisdom of Ecclesiastes? I want to pray for us, and I got a couple of announcements, and I'll send you on your way. Can you bow your heads with me? God, thanks for the book of Ecclesiastes. It's so great. It's a good invention of yours. And God, may we be people who experience joy, the joy of the simple but awesome things that you place in our life, and especially the joy of you. And Lord, may we be people who are free to participate in all the moments of our lives, the ups and the downs, and know and be aware of your presence with us in all of those times. And may we be people who are recklessly, ridiculously generous, no matter what people think of us, who cares about our reputation. And may we experience your nearness in the process of doing that. And all the people said, amen.